Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 744, The Shape of Things to Come. This program is being recorded on June 5th of the year 2011. In this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at, obviously, things that may or may not happen down the road. These are things that are being conceived of by some very powerful and, in most cases, extremely reactionary people. And in turn, we're going to be taking a look at what appears to be taking place right now. A few points of information. You're going to be hearing the word libertarian a great deal. Take that with a grain of salt, because what really lurks behind such benign, even attractive-sounding terms as libertarian, and who's not for liberty or freedom, who's not for freedom, really is, at one level, corporate license. By that, I don't mean licensing someone to use a product for profit, but rather allowing powerful corporate interests the freedom to do as they see fit. And beyond that, what we're looking at is a fundamental conflict between what these people and institutions view as freedom and democracy. I want to note that some of the same people are involved with the tech world, specifically one of the prime movers and shakers here in the Silicon Valley, a very formidable individual, brilliant individual, and I suspect a malevolent individual named Peter Thiel. Thiel is a primary venture capitalist who had much to do with the founding of PayPal. We took a look at Thiel at considerable length in For the Record 718, talking about Facebook. It's called In Your Facebook. Thiel was one of the major people, is one of the major people who helped to underwrite Facebook. And in turn, Thiel has some extreme right-wing views that he has always held. He moves in the same circles as the Koch brothers. And indeed, he and a fellow named Patry Friedman, the grandson of right-wing economic guru Milton Friedman, are very closely identified with the Koch brothers' various, quote, libertarian, unquote, institutions. We're going to begin this discussion with a look at the seasteading movement. Now, this is something in which the very wealthy would be, and one version has it that they will be living on offshore platforms, another on what are called utopia liners. This basically will enable some extremely wealthy individuals to circumvent the inconveniences of nationhood and citizenship, i.e. paying taxes and being accountable to the general concept of the social contract. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article, or a puff piece, perhaps, one might say, from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, June 1st of 2011. This is a story by Nellie Bowles about the seasteading movement and one of its primary advocates, a fellow named Patry Friedman, who is holding forth right here in the Silicon Valley. Patry Friedman, his first name is spelled P-A-T-R-I, is the grandson of right-wing economic guru Milton Friedman. And we're going to talk more about how some of Milton Friedman's theories have been put into play around the world as a result of not only economic and social disaster, but in some cases, specifically as the result of covert operations. And some of those covert operations were launched by people associated with the Seasteading Institute. We're going to take a look in particular at overlaps between the Seasteading Institute, and the seasteading movement, sort of the ultimate in what Lucy Commissar refers to as offshore, and something called the Frontier Group. Now, the Frontier Group has a strong interlocking directorate with the Carlyle Group, the powerful private equity firm, which could literally be thought of as something of a government mover. It brings together interests and people like George H.W. Bush, Margaret Thatcher, the Bin Laden family, and others. We've looked at the Carlyle Group at considerable length in the past. So when we're looking at the seasteading movement, it's heavily overlapped with the Frontier Group, which in turn has an interlocking directorate with the Carlyle Group. And as we will see, the economic theories of Milton Friedman and the notion of economic freedom are going to be front and center here. Again, from the Chronicle of June 1st of 2011, article by Nellie Bowles, headline, Dreamer floats his plan to build a city on the sea. Milton Friedman's grandson, Patry, has a vision that might have made The Economist proud, to build a floating libertarian nation 12 miles off the coast of California. Billed as Burning Man meets Silicon Valley meets the water, the planned nation flotilla would be constructed on a variety of barges and water platforms within sight of San Francisco. It would include everything from homes, schools, and hospitals to bikes for transportation and aqua farms for food. More about some of the variations. One variation has the focal point of these actual residences being utopia liners, giant seagoing vessels the size of a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. The essence of what Patry Friedman is talking about, and beyond that, his powerful venture capital backer, the brilliant, the formidable Peter Thiel, an individual who may very well have connections with the Borman Capital Network, about which I've spoken so often. Skipping down in this article, those in academic circles have balked at the seasteading movement. Quote, the whole thing is so far from any kind of conventional urban planning, unquote, says UC Berkeley professor of architecture Margaret Crawford. The physical premises are just ridiculous, unquote. But that hasn't stopped Friedman and his think tank staff of 10 at the Seasteading Institute in Sunnyvale from going full steam ahead. Backed almost entirely by venture capitalist Peter Thiel, who co-founded PayPal, the team plans to seastead, colonize the sea beyond the reach of existing nations. Now, here is the essence of this. Recall, against this background, that Mussolini referred to his fascist system as, quote, the corporate state, unquote. Listen to this. This is what the seasteading movement really aims at. Returning to the article, Friedman's mission is to open a political vacuum into which people can experiment with startup governments that are, quote, consumer-oriented, constantly competing for citizens, unquote, he says. I envision tens of millions of people in an Apple or a Google country, unquote, where the high-tech giants would govern and residents would have no vote. Quote, if people are allowed to opt in, or out, you can have a successful dictatorship, unquote, the goateed Friedman says, wiggling his toes in pink Vibram slippers. A successful dictatorship. That sounds intriguing, doesn't it? Also sounds very much like a corporate state, a Google or Apple country in which the citizens would have no vote. A somewhat less benign, more critical, and definitely less fawning analysis of the seasteading movement was penned by Mark Ames, who wrote for the Alternet website. This is from an Alternet post of June 2nd on 2010. It's headlined, The Really Creepy People Behind the Libertarian-Inspired Billionaire Sea Castles. This reads in part, what happens when Americans plunder America and leave it broken, destitute, and seething mad? Where do these fabulously wealthy Americans go with their loot if America isn't a safe, secure, or even desirable place to spend their riches? What if they lose faith in their gated communities because those plush, gated communities are surrounded by millions of pissed-off Americans stripped of their entitlements and who now want in? We finally have the answer, and you're not going to like it. A new fleet of castles that float in the oceans. The super wealthy are already building their first floating castle, a billion-dollar-plus luxury liner that offers permanent, multi-million-dollar housing with the best protection of all, moats made of oceans, keeping the land-based Americans they've plundered at a safe distance. The first such floating castle has been christened the Utopia. The South Korean firm Samsung has been contracted to build the $1.1 billion ship due to be launched in 2013. Already, orders are coming in to buy one of the Utopia's 200 or so mansions for sale, which range in price from about $4 million for the smallest condos to over $26 million for 6,600 square foot estates, unquote. The largest mansion is a whopping 40,000 square feet and sells for $160 million. It's the first of its kind to offer permanent housing units to buyers, and there'll be plenty on board the Utopia for the global elite inhabitants to keep themselves entertained. An outdoor movie theater, casino, miniature golf course, nightclubs, restaurants, shops, and a water park for the elite's heirs featuring a lazy river, rock climbing wall, and water slides. At nearly 1,000 feet, the Utopia is almost as long as a nuclear-powered Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. The floating castle is a long-time dream of libertarian oligarchs, a place where they can live their lives in peace, free from the teeming masses of starving losers and indebted parasites and their tax demands. Since they've grown so rich off of America, they have enough spare change to fund projects like the Seasteading Institute run by Milton Friedman's grandson, Patry Friedman, and financed by the bizarre right-wing PayPal founder, Peter Thiel. It couldn't have come a moment sooner for Milton Friedman's grandson, who was best known until recently for running a grotesque advice blog for married swingers, PUA4LTR, Pickup Advice for Long-Term Relationships. Actually, Patry Friedman ran that Pickup Advice blog with his wife. The two of them are apparent big-time cyber swingers, apparently, posting blog entries saying things like, "Why shouldn't husbands become pickup artists? Because otherwise, your wife will talk like those wives on the blog, 'My husband is annoying,'" unquote. Both Thiel and Milton Friedman's grandson see democracy as the enemy. This last sentence again, because this is important, and this dovetails directly with the Cato Institute of the billionaire Koch brothers, and indeed both Thiel and Patry Friedman are running mates, so to speak, of the Koch brothers. Both Thiel and Milton Friedman's grandson see democracy as the enemy. Last year, Thiel wrote, quote, "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible," at about the same time that Milton Friedman's grandson proclaimed, quote, "Democracy is not the answer," unquote. Both published their anti-democracy proclamations in the same billionaire Koch family-funded outlet Cato Unbound, one of the oldest billionaire-fed libertarian welfare dispensaries. Friedman's answer for Thiel's democracy problem is to build offshore libertarian pod fortresses where the libertarian way rules. It's probably better for everyone if Milton Friedman's grandson and Peter Thiel leave us forever for their libertarian ocean lair. Thiel believes that America went down the tubes ever since it gave women the right to vote, and he was outed as the sponsor of accused felon James O'Keefe's smear videos that brought Acorn to ruin. While Thiel and Friedman are busy cooking up their libertarian dystopia, the Frontier Group investment firm, an offshoot of the Carlyle Group, has already entered the realization phase with the Utopia floating castle. Now, again, a point of information here. This may have sounded a bit much to some people, although, again, noting the profound influence of the formidable Peter Thiel. Again, one of the prime movers in the venture capital and high-tech world, and an individual thinks that America went down the tubes since it gave women to the vote. Again, we're gave women the vote. This is some real antediluvian S-blank-blank-blank here, people. And if it sounds a bit far out, well, it is, but note some of the people behind it. Again, the seasteading movement is being backed, in addition to Peter Thiel, who is financing and underwriting the Seasteading Institute of Patry Friedman, Milton Friedman's grandson, who's looking to find, quote, "a successful dictatorship," unquote. The Seasteading Institute is being backed by the Frontier Group, an offshoot of the Carlyle Group, with which it has an interlocking directorate. And as we're going to see, one of the main people involved with this is Frank Carlucci, one of the prime movers in the world of covert operations for the last several decades. So we're talking about some people here that can get things done. And beyond that, these are people who can make things get done. And if people don't want to do them, these are people who can damn well make them do them, or perhaps neutralize them. Continuing. While Thiel and Friedman are busy cooking up their libertarian dystopia, the Frontier Group investment firm, an offshoot of the Carlyle Group, has already entered the realization phase with the utopia floating castle. Frontier Group was founded by some of the same big names from the notorious Carlyle Group, the private equity firm that brought together right-wing oligarchs like George H.W. Bush and other top American officials with their billionaire pals in Saudi Arabia like the Bin Laden family, who together raked in enormous profits thanks to the war on terror that their kids W and Osama launched. While neither Bush nor the Bin Ladens are principals in the Frontier Group, its founding director, Frank Carlucci, is a name they know well, and one you should know well, too. Carlucci ran the Carlyle Group as its chairman from 1989 through 2005, right around the time that the wars started going undeniably bad and floating castles started to look like a viable plan. But Carlucci's past is much weirder and scarier than most of us care to know. Whether it's his strangely timed appearances in some of the ugliest assassinations and coups in modern history, or serving as Carter's number two man in the CIA and Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, if Frank Carlucci, nicknamed Creepy Carlucci and Spooky Frank, is the founding director of a firm that's building floating castles, it's a bad sign for those of us who are going to be left behind. I'll get into Carlucci's partners in the Frontier Group in a moment, but first, let's reacquaint ourselves with Frank Carlucci. From an early age, Carlucci learned the importance of getting to know the right people in the right places. He studied at Princeton in the mid-1950s, where, as luck should have it, Carlucci roomed with Donald Rumsfeld. Both Carlucci and Rumsfeld shared a passion for Greco-Roman wrestling at Princeton, and both went on to serve in the Navy after their college careers. Their paths would split and merge again several times over the next few decades, even as they remained close personal friends throughout their lives. In the late 1950s, Carlucci briefly served as an executive at a lingerie manufacturer, Janssen, the Victoria's Secret of its day, but quickly left to join the State Department. There then is a description of Frank Carlucci's involvement with covert operations, including the operations in the Congo in the early 1960s that wound up installing Joseph Mobutu in power, and a curriculum vitae, so to speak, of Frank Carlucci's involvement with the National Security Establishment, and in particular with covert operations. I'm going to skip over this. There will be a link to this article in the description, 4 for the record 744, so listeners who are not familiar with the particulars of Frank Carlucci's career in the National Security Establishment and the reason why he is so inextricably linked with the world of covert operations can basically play catch-up here. Suffice it to say that Frank Carlucci is one of those individuals manifestly well-equipped to see to it that highly improbable-sounding schemes like the seasteading scheme and the notion that perhaps democracy is incompatible with freedom and the goal of crafting, quote, a successful dictatorship, well, those are things Frank Carlucci knows how to do. We're going to skip from his history of involvement with covert operations, and once more, we're going to revisit the Carlyle Group, which has an interlocking directorate with Carlucci and the Frontier Group. In 1989, Carlucci left, that's left becoming Secretary, National Security Advisor and Defense Secretary under Reagan. In 1989, Carlucci left to become chairman of the fledgling Carlyle Group, which subsequently morphed into the monster we remember it by, using its highly paid A-list of public officials to lobby big government for lucrative contracts, privating off of privatized rest stops and unnecessary arms contracts, leaving the public to foot the bill while guys like Carlucci run around preaching the benefits of private enterprise. Carlucci may be the scariest of the Frontier Group bunch building the floating castles, but he is among his kind. Other Carlyle Group directors who joined Carlucci at Frontier include David Robb, who headed up Carlyle's investments in defense and aerospace, Sanford McDonnell, the former CEO of McDonnell Douglas and one-time head of the Boy Scouts of America, and Norman Augustine, another ex-president of the Boy Scouts, another Princeton alum, and former board director at the scandal-plagued Riggs Bank. By the way, the Riggs Bank, as we're going to see, is not only inextricably linked with some of the investigations into September 11th, but with the world of covert operations just like Frank Carlucci. And again, Norman Augustine, a former director of the Riggs Bank. Riggs Bank became one of those dark, unsolved mysteries of the Bush-Cheney War on Terror. After the attacks on 9/11, the FBI discovered that Saudi government officials used accounts at Riggs Bank to wire funds to at least two known associates of the Saudi hijackers who crashed Flight 77 into the Pentagon. Riggs was also implicated in the Britain-Saudi $3 billion bribery scandal in which British aerospace bribes were wired through Riggs' accounts to Saudi officials in return for lucrative contracts. One of Riggs Bank's top executives was Jonathan Bush, the brother of George H.W. Bush, after Riggs bought out Jonathan Bush's bank in 1997 and appointed him as a director. In 2005, with Riggs embroiled in investigations and scandals, Riggs pled guilty to money laundering In 2005, with Riggs embroiled in investigations and scandals, Riggs pled guilty to money laundering Augusto Pinochet's stolen funds and the funds of various Equatorial Guinea officials. It was taken over by PNC Bank with the approval of Fed Chair Alan Greenspan. Even after the Washington Post revealed that Riggs' billionaire chairman flew Greenspan's wife, MSNBC anchor Andrea Mitchell, on the company jet. But the weirdest of all the Frontier Group directors has to be founding director Danny Pang. Last year, the Wall Street Journal reported that Pang embezzled hundreds of millions of dollars from his private equity firm PEM Group. Pang claimed he was investing money in dead peasants' insurance, life insurance policies for people considered likely to die, but in secret, Pang confided to PEM Group's ex-president that he ran it as a Ponzi scheme. That sparked a fresh FBI investigation into Danny Pang's crimes, which led back to the unsolved murder of his wife, Janie Louise Pang, a 33-year-old ex-stripper who was shot to death execution-style in their Irvine, California home in 1997. The same year, Pang was accused of embezzling $3 million from another fund he worked at. There was plenty of reason to suspect Danny Pang of murdering his wife. He beat her so often, breaking her nose on one occasion, that police were called in on at least four occasions before her murder. She'd had him tailed by a private detective who discovered Danny holding hands with another woman shortly before Danny Pang's wife was murdered. Danny had known ties to the Taiwanese triad mob. He took the Fifth and refused to cooperate in the murder trial and reportedly threatened Janie's friends after her murders, demanding to know what Janie told them about his business activities. Here is a description of the actual murder of Pang's wife from the LA Times. According to the family maid and two of Pang's children, a clean-cut man with a pencil-thin mustache arrived at the door asking for her husband. The pair talked casually for a couple of minutes until the man drew a semi-automatic pistol. Pang began running, and the maid, terrified, spirited Pang's children out the back door. Within minutes, the killer caught up with Pang, who tried to hide in her bedroom closet. The killer fired several .380 caliber rounds and left her to bleed to death as she lay in a fetal position. Somehow, trial ended with a hung jury, and Danny Pang went on to join Frank Carlucci and the Boy Scouts presidents to start building the world's first billion-dollar floating castle to spirit away all that stolen money in luxury. But Pang was apparently too careless for their taste. He was outed last spring in the Wall Street Journal, and in September of 2009, Danny Pang was found dead of unknown causes in his Newport Beach home. So, again, it sounds great, doesn't it? Freedom, libertarian, offshore, whoopee, sounds just wonderful. Actually, these are some very formidable individuals indeed. Now, we're going to take a look at one of the ventures that has been engaged in or underwritten by Peter Thiel, the same guy who had a lot to do with Facebook, which really will it could be viewed as something of a data mining operation for just about any to be used against anybody who signs up with Facebook. Peter Thiel again feels that America began going downhill when we gave women the vote. He feels that freedom and democracy are incompatible. And again, associated with the Koch brothers, and at another level, associated very possibly, as we looked at in For the Record 718, with the Bormann Capital Network and the Underground Reich. Peter Thiel co-founded a tech firm that is deeply involved in intelligence activities and counter-terrorist activities. Note that the counter-terrorist paradigm, so to speak, can also be used to simply track and work against or neutralize anyone who would be deemed an enemy. Note that the Thiel-funded tech intelligence firm, Palantir, is run by a guy who also hooked up with Peter Thiel in Frankfurt, Germany. And that is more than a little interesting indeed. This is a guy named Alex Karp, K-A-R-P. An article in the Wall Street Journal about the Palantir article was published on September 4th of 2009. Excuse me, about the Palantir firm, I should say. This is called How a Team of Geeks Cracked Spy Trade. It's by Shobin Gorman. It's datelined Palo Alto, California. And skipping down, we read, Palantir's software has helped root out terrorist financing networks, revealed new trends in roadside bomb attacks, and uncovered details of Syrian suicide bombing networks in Iraq, according to current and former U.S. officials familiar with the events. It has also foiled a Pakistani suicide bombing plot on Western targets and discovered a spy infiltration of an allied government. It is now being used by the Central Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. As we'll see, it also may be being used against enemies of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and labor unions. More about that later. Continuing. Yet Palantir, which takes its name from the Seeing Stones in the Lord of the Rings series, remains an outlier among government security contractors. It rejected advice to hire retired generals to curry favor with the agencies and hired young government analysts frustrated by working with slow-footed technology. The company's founders knew little about intelligence gathering when they started out. Instead, they went on a fact-finding mission working with analysts to build the product from scratch. Quote, "We were very naive. We just thought this was a cool idea," unquote, says Palantir's 41-year-old chief executive Alexander Karp, whose usual dress is a tracksuit jacket, blue jeans, and red leather sneakers. "I underestimated how difficult it would be." More about the founding of Palantir, which again works with the federal government and which may also be being used against labor unions and political opponents of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, whose head, John Donahue, is a fierce enemy of Barack Obama. However, we're going to be talking more about Palantir and Peter Thiel and some of the other shapes of things to come in Side 2, because this concludes Side 1. Please, for an understanding of these broadcasts, use the Spitfire website in particular, the For the Record program descriptions, and the books. I made reference to the Bormann Capital Network. That refers to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. An understanding of that is essential to a real comprehension of these broadcasts. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 744, The Shape of Things to Come. This program is being recorded on June 5th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.